It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Listeners to the ongoing New Dimensions Public Radio interview series know that over the past 20 years, we have spoken with many of the most important and forward-looking people on the planet. Our purpose is to expand the landscape of possibilities, challenge conventional thinking and ideas about the way things are, push our self-imposed limits, and explore the limitless territory of what it means to be a human being on the planet at this time. Of the numerous individuals who have graced our microphones, no one has been more provocative or profoundly challenging to our current take on reality than the man known throughout the world as Jay Krishnamurti. Born in the south of India to an impoverished Indian family in May 1895, Krishnamurti was chosen at the age of 11 by Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbetter of the Theosophical Society, a worldwide and very popular spiritual group at the time, to be the next Maitreya, or world teacher. He was educated in India and later in England. After more than 20 years of schooling and preparation by the Theosophists, at a meeting in Holland in 1929, with 3,000 members in attendance, Krishnamurti stunned the audience with his pronouncement that he was repudiating the notion that he was a vehicle for leading humanity into a new age, and certainly he was not the world teacher. "Truth is a pathless land," he said. "You cannot approach it by any religion, any sect." During his lifetime, he influenced millions, and his insights continue to resonate more than a decade after his death in 1986. His words have deeply affected such notables as Dr. Jonas Salk, Aldous Huxley, Joseph Campbell, Van Morrison, Henry Miller, Deepak Chopra, and countless other students of the spiritual path, ranging from scientists and philosophers to artists and creative people of all kinds. Practical, profound, and timeless, Krishnamurti's ideas, which reject the prejudices of traditional learning and celebrate personal, spiritual freedom and the individual's quest for truth, are inspiring and relevant now more than ever. The following represents the first of two dialogues that I had the privilege of conducting with Krishnamurti. Listen deeply and enjoy. Welcome to New Dimensions. Krishnaji, welcome. You've written and spoken a great deal about meditation, and certainly in America there's a great deal of misunderstanding about meditation, and I think it might be useful for you to speak about your understanding of what meditation really is.
I think we ought to talk over first what generally meditation is supposed to be. There is the Zen meditation. There's the Buddhist meditation. There's the different kinds of Hindu meditation. And also, they introduced the Tibetan, Mahayana and Hinayana, south and north. And also all the latest gurus who have come here talking about meditation. After all, meditation, the meaning of that word is to ponder over, to think over, to be concerned, discern. It's not what we are talking about. All such forms of meditation is a kind of exercise of will, or an attempt to achieve something. a state of illumination, if you like to call it, a state of peace, state of kind of bliss and so on. Or it might be considered as a relaxation. One considers all these forms of meditation are really not meditation at all. From what we have gone into it very, very deeply with all the people concerned of various types of meditation, they ultimately, after a great deal of discussion, and they agree that their form of meditation is really an exercise of will, effort, a sense of achievement, and so on. The word meditation is not only ponder over, think over, and so on, but the word, both in Sanskrit, means to measure, and to be free of all measurement. I don't know if I make myself clear.
Yes.
To be free from comparison, from becoming. Here in this country, they have used the word mantra a great deal. The meaning of that word in Sanskrit, the root meaning of that word, is consider not becoming. Think about it. Go into it. And also, the word mantra means to to put away all self-centered activity. You know, the depth of that statement, very few understand it. So, meditation is not separate something from daily life. If it is separate, it merely becomes an escape, a romantic imagination, and all that kind of nonsense. But real meditation is to be concerned with one's behavior, one's relationship, not only with one's own little family, but with the world. Because the human beings have created the society in which we live, which is rotten, corrupt, immoral, and all the rest of it. And meditation is a form of understanding one's relationship to the world and one's relationship to nature. So it becomes not a self-centered activity of some kind of escape from daily boredom and weariness and the general nonsense of life, but it means a tremendous inquiry in which there is no illusion, no self-deception, no imaginative theories and escapes. I hope I'm making myself clear.
Inquiry implies a goal of some type.
No.
What are we inquiring after?
Inquiring into the whole nature of thinking. Inquiring into the nature of why human beings are behaving in this way. Inquiring into or probing into the depth of life, what it all means. If there is something beyond the ordinary, daily, monotonous, wearisome life, to inquire if there is something sacred. So one must begin with doubt. That's one of the things in meditation. Question, inquire, probe, doubt. And not follow any particular system, because that's invented by thought, by another man. And also meditation means inquiring into the whole nature of yourself, your consciousness, and so on. It's a very complex thing, not just meditate for 20 minutes and relax and carry on with your daily, ugly, brutal life.
Certainly part of what you're saying is it involves us having to release the conditioning that we've all been programmed with as we've come through life.
That's right.
Is there a method to that process of releasing conditioning?
See, the moment you use the word method, it means this: a process, a system. You practice day after day till you reach something.
Like Zazen or something like that.
Which means your brain, which is already mechanical, programmed, if you follow a system, a method, you make it more mechanical, more routine, more stupid. Whereas this meditation, as you began to question, is something very, very complex. It's not just something you play with. It's part of your daily life.
So it's important to bring meditation into every part of one's life.
Life is meditation. Not you bring the meditation. You understand, say, you have to question, doubt. In Christianity, that is denied. Because if you doubted the authority of the church, you were either burnt in the old days or tortured. If you really doubted the whole structure of Christian mythology and Christian doctrine, it'll non-existent. You will destroy it. Whereas one of the things in Buddhism and Hinduism is you must begin with questioning, doubt, go into it. Don't accept authority.
Can the very non-acceptance or non-believing become a belief system?
Of course, you can make it. But to question why one has belief at all, belief implies a sense of security in some form of ideal, in some form of God and so on. That's why should one have belief at all about anything? You don't believe sun rises and sunsets. You don't believe in the constellation of Orion. You don't believe London exists, it's there. Belief has really, like ideologies, have divided man. The communist ideology, the capitalist ideology, and so on. One of the divisions in the world is brought about by ideologies, by ideals, beliefs. And so there is always conflict between human beings. One of the questions is to find out if man can live without conflict. That requires tremendous probing, not just yes, he can or he cannot. Why do human beings live in conflict? Why have they accepted conflict as the way of life for the last 40, 50,000 years?
Some people say it's human nature.
No. You see, that's another slogan we accept. But we have never inquired why human beings live the way we do. Why? We are always have wars, why each human being in his relationship with another, intimate or otherwise, is perpetually in conflict. See, to inquire into that requires a great, not only intellectual comprehension, but it requires self-examination. Not examination according to some psychologies, whether Freudian and so on, but to actually inquire into yourself. And in inquiring, one begins to discover that your consciousness, with all its reactions, after all, do you want to go into all this? Your interest in all this?
Yes.
I'm talking, I don't know if you want me to go on.
Please.
Some people don't accept, some psychologists don't accept consciousness. They say only there is action and reaction. Nothing else. Mechanical process. But if you go further into it, you see that human consciousness, which is not only action-reaction, which is mechanical, biological and psychological, you also see that human consciousness is its content, what it's made of, which is faith, belief, superstition, illusions, fear, pleasure, ideals, ideologies, my country, your country, my God and your God, all that and more, if you want to go into it, is our consciousness, is what one is. A linguistic, psychological conditioning. Right? That's what we are. What we are is what every human being in the world is, psychologically. They suffer. They are in turmoil, uncertain, anxious, lonely, depressed, weary of this whole business of earning money, money, money. So, if you go to India or Japan, anywhere in the world, every human being goes through this. Whether black or purple or blue or whatever color they are, whatever race they are, whether they are totalitarians or whether they are other. So human consciousness is not my consciousness or your consciousness. It's human consciousness. I don't know.
Of which we are a part.
We are that. Not a part, we are that.
We are that.
And therefore, we are not individuals. In psychologically.
So I have to give up who I think I am.
Yeah. Who you are is merely your name, your form, or your bank account if you have one, and your passport.
Most of us become pretty identified with ourselves.
Yes.
We like ourselves, and it's kind of a fearful thing to think about giving up ourselves.
No, it's not a fearful thing. It's a factual thing. One has lived in such fanciful illusions. If I think, sir, that I am an individual free to do what I like, this is what's happening in the world. Right? Everybody wants to do what he wants to do, what he likes. And he calls that freedom, which is creating such havoc in the world. So, in questioning all this, questioning what society is being made by us, If we are in turmoil, society is in turmoil. If our house inside is burning, we create an ugly society. We are violent, we create... We have divided the world into geographically into America, Russia, and India, and Japan, and so on. So nationalities have been one of the causes of war. It is glorified tribalism. Obviously.
Well, one might say that nationalities and the separations that are created are really out of our mind because we tend to
therefore, sir,
separate
that's why,
and compartmentalize.
That's why you begin to inquire what is thinking, what is thought, why thought has made this society, why thought has created gods and the churches, and it's all the work of thought. I mean, there's no question about it. You can't say it's divine revelation. One can say it, but it has no validity. It's just a belief like any other belief.
So there's a direct relationship about how we between how we think and the world around us.
Yeah. So one begins to ask, if what this part of your question with which you began about meditation, why thought has created this? If you grant that thought, thinking has brought about the great divisions in the world, why thought has brought about wars in the world, perpetual wars. At the beginning you kill one or two men with an arrow, now you can blast off human beings by the million. You follow where? That's what we call evolution.
We've created terms like megadeaths.
Yes, sir. So, what is thinking? Why has thinking become so extraordinarily important in the world? Technologically, you must think to create this microphone. To create the airplane, to create a submarine, to create the neutron bomb. But we have also thought and created God. God is our creation.
So as you've said once or twice, God is disorder because he's a reflection of our disorder.
Yes.
We've created that God.
If you accept... It becomes so absurd, the whole thing. So we have to not only investigate what is thinking, but also we ought to probe into the whole question of what is intelligence.
We usually associate with collecting knowledge in our brains
as
intelligence.
Yes. Being programmed in a certain way, using that program more cunningly. It's once you admit, sir, that thought is responsible for everything, right? Both psychologically and technologically. Thought is limited. I think all scientists would agree to that. One has talked a great deal to other scientists, they would all see this, obviously. Because knowledge is limited. There is no complete knowledge about anything, at any time, in the future or now. Right? Perhaps you won't agree to this.
Well, when we think, we're thinking about things that have passed already.
Which means what? Knowledge. Thinking is the response of memory. If I have no memory, I couldn't think. Memory implies memories stored in the brain. Memory is the response of knowledge. Knowledge is experience, right? Experience, knowledge, memory, thought. So, as knowledge is always, will always be limited, so thinking is limited. Thinking may imagine it is, it can imagine it's illimitable, but it's still limited. I don't know if
you're suggesting that chain can be broken.
Yes. Absolutely. But that requires not some kind of acceptance of authority. It requires examination, probing, questioning, doubting, which very, very few people are willing to do because they live in false security.
Well, you know, in America, Krishnaji, there are probably more how-to books sold than any other type of book.
I know.
Everyone's looking for how-to.
How-to.
How do I do it?
Yes.
Whatever it is.
Yes.
How do I do it?
Yes. And also, the specialists are now becoming, are willing to tell you how to do it.
There are lots of people out there that are willing to tell you.
Yes. If you want to have done your hair properly, you go to a specialist. How to raise a baby, how to think, what to do. So gradually, I don't know if in this country one is aware that you are all becoming slaves to specialists. How to make up your face, how to... The other day I heard the most extraordinary thing. As a woman was asking, especially how to sleep with her husband. He follows her. It's incredible.
Yes, it is. We pride ourselves about being a free people.
You see, that's what I'm questioning. So, if we could go into the question of what is thinking? Why thought has made life so utterly wearisome, cruel, bestial, for what it is now. If you once admit, not only logically, but actually, that human consciousness is not individual consciousness, it is the consciousness of all humanity. Right? That's very difficult. To not only intellectually accept it, but to feel it, then you become tremendously responsible for what you're doing.
Once you feel that.
Of course.
Krishnaji, you were going to continue in just 1 minute.
You're listening to an interview with the late J. Krishnamurti. My name is Michael Toms, and this is New Dimensions.
Krishnaji, when you say feeling the whole, there's a lot of energy behind those words when you say them. And I'm reminded about what you've said about we're not being serious about the deeper issues of life. And relating that back to what you're saying, feeling the whole, perhaps the reason we don't feel the whole or can't even think about or move ourselves to feeling the whole is that we're not serious about the deeper issues of life.
So it's not a question of feeling it, that you can imagine you're living in a whole, a feeling of wholeness of life. But one has to, and what does wholeness mean? To be whole implies not a living a life in which there is no fragmentation. Business life, artistic life, poetic life.
A unified life.
Life is one. And we have broken it up. Broken it up professionally, as in career, psychologically, and religiously.
It goes back to thinking again in
that
fragmented
just
way
it. So thinking has produced this world, no question about it. The marvelous cathedrals and the things that are inside the cathedrals, which are considered sacred, but is the invention of thought. All the Roman structure of hierarchy is the invention of thought. So, that instrument, which is thought, has produced this world. The chaos, the wars, the thought has killed, right? So, that instrument is no longer valid, which very few will accept. It's not valid because it's worn out. It's producing problem after problem. The politicians try to solve one problem. In the very solution of that problem, they're increasing multiple problems. The scientists are doing the same.
But there are well-intentioned, sincere, dedicated people who see the problem and feel that there are solutions that can be had by thinking.
Thinking. That's just it. So that instrument with which human beings have used for thousands of years is worn out, is no longer valid, is no longer worthwhile, because we are in a both outwardly and inwardly, we are in a great crisis. Economically, socially, morally, in every way, we're in a tremendous crisis. And all this is brought about by thought. And if we once see that thought, which human beings have used, is no longer the quality of strength, is no longer valid, keep on repeating that word, then we must look to another instrument. Is there another instrument? Or is man condemned forever to this way of life, which is brought about by thought? I don't know if you see this clearly.
Yeah, it's very clear.
So, is it possible for human beings to find a totally different dimension of an instrument which is not the product of thought, which is altogether different? Point out, one says it is possible. There is such an instrument. Not the scientists, the biologists, and the doctors are dividing the brain left and right and all the rest of it. After all, so look at it this way, I'll put it this way. We have used knowledge as a means of achievement. And great many philosophers and biologists say man will ascend through knowledge. Like Bronowski and others have said, step by step by step. That's called evolution. Evolution implies time. Time means a movement which is thought. Time is thought. I don't. And Time as evolution, time as thought, has not solved a single human problem. Psychological problem. It has solved problems of communication, problems of travel, and so on, so on, so on. But psychologically, inwardly, knowledge has not changed man. He has been what he has been for the last 50,000 years or more. And we say, give me time, we'll change. Time may be the enemy of man. I don't know if you're following all this.
Yes, I'm following.
So, is there another instrument which will radically, psychologically change the human, not only the human cells in the brain, but also fundamentally psychologically? You understand? Now, one must question it, which means one must doubt the validity of thought, right, and see its place in the technological, in the world of communication, so on, the world of business, so on. And psychologically, has it any place at all? We think it has. That's the illusion we live in. Because we want security, right? Every human being wants security. The greatest intellect and the poorest uneducated person who doesn't know how to read or write, he says, give me food, clothes and shelter. I don't care for anything else. I don't know, we have lived in poverty. We know this. See, is there security in the things thought has created?
They don't seem to. There doesn't seem to be security there.
Big pardon?
There doesn't seem to be security in the things thought has created.
No, it's a fact. In nationality, there's no security. In the whole invention of by thought of the churches and religions, there is no security there.
Sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking there
is. That's right. So is there security in the things the thought has created? If there is no security there, is there a security that is irrevocable, unchangeable? One says there is. But to find that out, one must move away from the whole time process.
So one has to move outside of time.
Yes. Not scientific fiction time, but time is brought about by thought. Yesterday, today and tomorrow. Yesterday is all the accumulation of million years.
Genetic memory.
That's memory. That's tradition. That's what I've been told, programmed. I'm a Catholic, Protestant, or a Hindu, Buddhist, all that kind of silly stuff. So, is there a move? Is there an instrument, a way of living, which is not the way of knowledge? It is, when you put it that way, it sounds crazy. But after examining, discussing with you just now, if one understands the limitation of knowledge, and therefore limitation of time, therefore, you cannot possibly look to time to change. which is called evolution, then your brain is working totally on a different way from the former. I don't know if you're following all this. Because you have set aside the importance of knowledge. Therefore, what is important is learning. Learning is not to accumulate. Learning. So, one begins to learn about fear. Whether man can ever live without fear. Because we must inquire into the other, go and find the instrument. Whether you can live not only psychologically, but deeply, most profoundly, whether the brain can ever find a place where it is no fear. We say there is such a thing.
How do you know that you're not fooling yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Because you begin with doubt. Doubt of everything you think, you feel. Doubt, question, probe into, say, whether you are really, when you say there is a sense of freedom from fear, is that real? So you watch, you question, you look. You never accept a thing. Therefore, there is no authority. Because man has sought security in authority. The church, the religions, and so on. So when one rejects all that as being the invention of thought and therefore limited and so on, then your brain now is not cluttered up, is not conditioned by time. I don't know if you're following all this. Look.
So it's a matter of recreating one's intention?
Not intention. There is no intention in this. You see, that's why intention implies thought. I intend to do something. I intend to become a business owner. It's still the very word creates the element of time. So one must be very, very careful in the usage of words.
Rigorous.
No, yes, sir. Rigorous. And the word must be understood by others, not your own meaning you give to words. Time we understand. Thought we understand. And we understand thought has come to its end. That's very difficult to accept for most people. Because they don't want to think. They don't want to look. They want, please tell me how to escape. The entertainment industry is now rampant. Footballs, cinemas, all the religious ceremonies are entertainments.
Well, clearly there's a lot of desire to
of course,
escape
of course,
what we see as the world around us.
So to find out if there's another instrument, you have to exercise your capacity, your way of living. Why knowledge has become so important?
Are we coming to intelligence?
Yes, sir. I'm coming to that slowly. Which means intelligence cannot exist without love. Love is not desire, pleasure, sensory, sexual responses. We have made love into all that. You see, as somebody said the other day, some time ago, that without jealousy, I have no love. Sounds so appalling. So trivial.
Yeah, it does sound trivial, actually.
But that person was very well known. Writer and scholar and all the rest of it.
Do you think love is something you can write about?
No, no. You can write it, but if there is no feeling there, if your heart is not, has no love, how can you talk about it? You may, a poet like Keats may have had this feeling, I don't know. But I'm saying there is no intelligence without love. And there cannot be love if you're ambitious. If there is conflict in you. And love is not the movement of thought. The picture it creates is not love. So love means the freedom from all conflict. It's not a negative state, but through negation you come to the positive. And with that, when there is that love, there is that intelligence, which is compassion. That intelligence is completely secure. That intelligence is security. But to come to that, one has to meditate. Not this all this silly stuff, money-making business. But one has to be very, very serious about all this. It isn't a passing thing for one day and then pick up another thing next day. One has to. This is one's life. If one doesn't understand one's life, how can you have intelligence? How can there be love and so on? So it's really requires a clear brain to think clearly, objectively, unemotionally, unromantically. And thought has created fear, pleasure, sorrow. Where there is sorrow, you cannot love. I know people think, if my son is dead, there is sorrow. Right? So I wonder if we realize that human beings have killed each other, and that has created enormous sorrow in the world. They're still doing it. How many women, men, wives have cried about this? For thousands of years. And nobody stops it. They talk about peace on earth. They don't mean it. To have peace on earth, one has to live peacefully. And that peace cannot be brought about through legislation. Peace means a state of my brain where there is no conflict and therefore there is no limitation, no division. You understand? Look. There is division now between the Arab and the Jew, the Muslim and the Hindu, the Christian and the non-Christian, and so on. So division creates conflict. Is it possible to live in this world now, married and all the rest of it, to live without division? That these are really very, very serious questions, not just pass on the television or radio for a few minutes. One has to give one's energy to find out all this. Not just read about it, or hope to achieve it someday or other. One has to give one's capacities, energies, thought into all this. And very few people are willing to do it. Tell me how. They're all concerned how to. So, to come back to your question, meditation is love and intelligence and compassion. Without that, life has no meaning. You can be a millionaire, a great president, prime minister, generals, what it is, or a business. All that has no meaning. Actually, they're just... So to live a life in which there is no conflict means no division. You're no longer a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Christian, an ideologist and theorist. In this way, so to live, there is great beauty in this. Beauty isn't the perception of something beautiful. It is the way of living. And without love and beauty and sense of immensity of the universe, this becomes rather trivial stuff. There are several people we happen to know who say you can't change the world. It'll go on for the rest of their life, world will go on, because they're conditioned, programmed, Catholic, Protestant, all the rest of it. And why waste your time on all this? Retire. Go back to some monastery or to some Himalayan cave or in jungle. Just live there. We don't accept that kind of thinking at all, because it's... Even you retire into your monastery, the thinking is going on. You may worship your particular symbol, your particular image, but it's still the product of thought. So through thought you cannot achieve the immensity of life.
So we have to move beyond thought.
Yes. Not give it its right value. To come here, to your house, and you have to follow certain rules, and you have to think, you have to watch. That thought is necessary. To learn language, thought is necessary. To go from here to there, thought is necessary. But psychologically inwardly, thought has no place. But to see that, in the seeing of it, is thought has its right place. But we don't take time to look at anything.
We're supposed to dismiss time, Krishnaji.
Yes, sir. We never look at the moon. Never look at a tree. live with it, look at it, see the beauty of it, see the strength of it, the quality of it. Or the moon or the stars we never look. All that we are concerned is to pleasure, money, and money gives you freedom, power, position, all the rest of it. One is not depressed or optimistic or pessimistic. These are facts. You can't, when you look at facts, it's neither optimistically or pessimistic. It's so. That thing is red. That's all.
Just like meditation is love.
Yes, sir.
Krishnaji, I want to thank you for being with us here today.
No, please.
You've been listening to the first of two dialogues that I conducted with the late J. Krishnamurti. More than 40 books and literally hundreds of audio tapes and videotapes have been produced based on Krishnamurti's talks when he was alive and are available from the Krishnamurti Foundation of America. Their website is www.kfa.org.
This is program number 1782.
For more information on J. Krishnamurti, go to www.jkrishnamurti.org, www.jkrishnamurti.org.
New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. Since 1973, New Dimensions Radio has produced programming covering the history of the future. For more information and a complimentary copy of the New Dimensions newsletter, or to order an audio copy of today's program using American Express, Visa, Discover, or MasterCard, call 1-800-388-8273. That's 1-800-388-TAPE. Or visit our website, newdimensions.org.